Hey guys, great news. Thanks to our partner Beta, this week we're giving away Withings Body Plus Wi-Fi Smart Scales. This scale has high accuracy and full body composition. Body Plus includes coaches, rewards, and it automatically sends all of your data to the free HealthMate app. With tools at hand such as trend screens and nutrition tracking, the Withings Body Plus Wi-Fi Smart Scale is the perfect way for users to track and achieve their weight loss goals. Enter this week's giveaway at www.mission.org/giveaway for a chance to win a free Withings Body Plus Wi-Fi Smart Scale. Or if you want to purchase, go directly to www.withings.com and enter Mission Daily 20 to get 20% off the Withings Body Plus Smart Scale. This code is only valid on withings.com or visit your nearby Beta store. Welcome to Mission Daily. On today's episode, Chad sits down with Kevin Kelly, founding executive editor of Wired Magazine. Kevin co-founded Wired Magazine in 1993 and served as its executive editor for its first 7 years of existence. Kevin is a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author for his most recent book, The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. He has also written a number of other books that are must-reads, including What Technology Wants and New Rules for the New Economy. On this episode, Chad and Kevin discuss the future of technological innovation, what we can expect to see, such as driverless cars, and when they will arrive.
So you think it's a bright future for the future of individual data?
I do. I am more optimistic than I've ever been. I think that we're headed towards the big long boom of fantastic progress. And that's not just for us who are privileged to be in Silicon Valley, but I think even for the whole world, that in general, these technologies will be a net positive. And the issues that are real and the problems that are real that we'll speak about are correctable. They are not inherently something that's going to stop this. My image of a kind of progress is like a car barreling down the road. You have to have brakes in order to be able to steer. And the faster it goes, the more important it is to have brakes. And so it is necessary to kind of look at the things that aren't working and try to fix them. But the more important part of the car is the engine, which is propelling it forward. And that's sort of what the general progress in technology is.
And especially with self-driving cars, I think it's a great opportunity to start talking about what choices do we trust machines with? Right. And the answer should be, according to the statistics, more than what we're allowing them to make right now. What would you say to that?
The analogy I use is that these things that we're making, these AIs and robots that will make decisions for us or make decisions on their own is a little bit like mind children. They're like our children. And so it's very scary when children grow up because they're going to be deciding things. They have great power. And in order to do that, you have to kind of convey or transmit values.
Right.
And that's sort of part of what we're talking about. But, you know, if we lived in a world, a science fiction alternative world where there was, you know, 7 billion people, but we never had children. Somehow we asexually cloned. Mm-hmm. And then someone came along with the idea of introducing children. We would totally reject it as an insane idea. What? You're going to have these little infants and they're going to grow up to have their own decision-making power. And they're going to, you know, and they can run things and drive cars.
So scary.
Yeah, it's like, no way.
Yeah.
That's a really bad idea. And so we're kind of like, this is the first time on the planet we're going to have these mind children, and it is very scary, but we have kind of an existence proof that it's possible to transmit values and guidance. And the thing about AI and all these things that we're talking about is that we're kind of overestimating the speed at which they're coming. Yes, technological speed is fast and it is getting faster, but the complexity of what it takes to have like a self-driving car with no steering wheel is so high that it's not going to happen this year. It's not going to happen 5 years. It's not going to happen even in 10 years. It's going to be a long time coming. And we will be having this conversation during that whole time. And we have enough time to actually try and make these systems work.
So you think that level five is a couple decades away?
Yes, many decades away.
Level five is essentially saying this is artificial general intelligence, correct?
Or no, I don't believe in that. I don't think there's such a thing.
Gotcha.
I would say level five is a self-driving car that has no steering wheel, meaning that it's completely navigating on its own anywhere on the planet that roads can go.
Sure.
And, you know, driving through Boston in the back alleys of Boston, or, you know, going to a ranch in Wyoming. So that would be level five for me. And that kind of, or at night during a rainstorm.
Right.
You know, that kind of smartness is just going to take a long time to get there.
Do you think?
Because in this case,
sure.
Because we have no tolerance for mistakes. In other words, it's like, it's not, can't be just like 99.5% good or 99.9. Right. It has to be six nines.
Better than the perfect human almost.
Or? Exactly. It has to be six nines deep sure. before we're going to be comfortable riding in that vehicle.
And do you think we're going to get there more quickly if we focus on LiDAR or machine vision, or is it both and something else?
Well, actually, it's both and it's even more. Just as when we moved from horse world to, say, the present day roads, it wasn't just that we took cars and put them on horse trails. We built this huge infrastructure, ramps, on ramps, divided highways,
a new culture,
new pave. Yes, the exit stops, the entire infrastructure, and then all the gasoline transport to support this new thing. The self-driving cars are going to require an equal transformation of the infrastructure. So it's just, you can't just put a steering wheelless car on a million of them, or millions of them, or tens of millions
on dumb roads.
On the road,
right?
On dumb roads. So we're going to have to actually upgrade this infrastructure to accommodate and prepare for and to assist these cars. And so you need the smart environment as well as the smart car. And so that's a huge build out, and that's what's necessary. It's not just LiDAR on a car and AI.
It's going to be a level of unprecedented infrastructure.
It's a huge infrastructural, where we have guidance on the side, we have smart traffic lights, we have so many other things that are going to be part of that system.
So those massive investments in infrastructure are typically the province of nation states and sovereign wealth funds. These are the type of people that invest there. Do you see the U.S. being willing or open to it starting to invest in infrastructure again, or is that not going to happen here?
That's a hard thing to predict. You know, who would predict that Trump would have won? So I can't say whether it's going to happen, but I would certainly think that it should happen. And I would sure. say that there's very few things that are as good as investment as infrastructure, except for one thing, which is a better investment, which is in basic science and technology research. I don't know whether the U.S. is going to. It's really hard to say. But
I mean, I personally hope they do.
Well, exactly. But, yeah. I hope they do. And it would make the most sense. And by the way, other countries like China are doing that. And so maybe we'll be shamed into doing it. It is by far the best thing we could do.
Do you think we get there by kind of advertising what's going on in these other countries like China? Do we catalyze some FOMO amongst policymakers and folks like that? Or what's maybe step one to getting there or creating that future?
Because I'm an American, you know, I think like American. And I have a certain amount of pride in America, but at the same time, I spend an awful lot of my life outside of America and in places like China. And so I'm much more a globalist at heart than most Americans. And so there is kind of races between countries, but I think that's actually, I think nationalism is a disease that we should try to eliminate. And if we can understand that we would all do better, the better that everybody else does. I think there is some forms of competition can be good and it helps innovation. So, and then it's going to be natural. But
competition is generally pretty brutal, right?
We wanted to take it in measure. We want to have competition in the right places.
Sure.
And we all want to understand that even the competition is really for the benefit of everybody, which is what we have this view in terms of the market is that your own self-interest can actually benefit everybody else. And so some of that showing off and pointing to other places that succeed can be beneficial. And there should be, you know, ways to run multiple different experiments, so to speak, political experiments. You try it this way, we'll try it this way, we'll see who's better. But I think what I would argue is that, well, then let's have an evidence-based policy. Let's look at the data and try and decide what to do based on what actually happened. And that's often not done. But I think more of that would be better. We could look at how other countries are funding their infrastructure and, you know, what happens. So, you know, there is one blank spot or blind spot in American kind of a view, which is that, and this is sort of a recent thing, which is this kind of idea that the government and the way it does things is like a total negative drain on everything. And it's completely wrong. Most of the innovation in technology, things like your iPhone to, you know, Uber, are based on research that was originally done by, funded by the US government.
Right.
And from GPS to, you know, transistors, all kinds of things. And even today, this is still happening, where some real fundamental discoveries that couldn't have been done by the market because they're just too out there, they're too long term. They aren't going to pay in the next quarter or the next 5 years. They have a longer gestation period that's outside of kind of VC world. Mm-hmm. And so what we haven't done is actually two things. We haven't actually acknowledged and promoted that aspect. And secondly, there is sort of a kind of awareness right now that actually some of that wealth being generated by the discoveries should go back into the system to help fund new ones. That they're actually, that the government in some way should actually retain some of that value that's been created by its funding so that it can keep it going. So it's not like we're going to tax it, fund it, and give away for free for everybody forever. Yeah, we'll tax and fund and we'll give the information, but we're going to retain some value that's been created from this to help keep this thing going.
So the role of the United States government then might be more of a VC than, or maybe they need to create their own sovereign wealth fund or something along those lines.
Well, no, I don't. I think that's a little too extreme. It's more of like, I wouldn't call it a tax, but there is a sense in which you license or in some ways have some residual income or some percent coming back into, you know, DARPA fund or whatever
to keep funding the research
to help, help. So it's not so that it can grow in a certain sense. You can kind of expand that pool
and measure and track progress.
Right.
But I think the amount of value that has been created from these inventions is currently unquantifiable. People think it's too complex to calculate, but maybe that's something we need to do is start calculating how much value was created by GPS, because it's got to be in the trillions, right?
So there are some economists who are trying to do those calculations, and for this very reason, to show that there might be a benefit in having some of that go back to the fund. That's and part of that would be for the very reason we're talking about, is it would illuminate the value, and so therefore maybe even increase our willingness to fund it. Because right now, most people don't know that. Most people think that a lot of the government funding for science is kind of, you know, this wasted, pointless, or, wasted, crazy stuff. And a lot of it is.
Sure.
But that's actually the price.
Right.
That's actually the price that you pay. And that's a good price, because what we haven't accounted for is actually the huge amount of value that that kind of basic research has generated.
So, Kevin, I would love to go back to earlier where I think you were talking about mind children.
Yeah.
So what is the future of child rearing like? Because in a sense, I see our mind children as technologies that can help us become better parents. And I think that ultimately becoming great parents is the only way we're going to make things better. What are your thoughts on that?
So I have two responses. One is the basic child rearing. The other one is about children in general. So I'm actually not a big believer in the role of technology in child rearing. I think it's far more important for kids growing up is to mold their character. And that's just, right now, at this point, a very human thing that's about being an example. I mean, you actually teach far more by what you do than by what you say.
Right.
And so,
so direct real world relationships are very important.
And so I believe that, you know, the skill that children, you know, young adult graduates from high school should have, there's really only one skill that should be aimed for in school, which is learning how to learn. Because whatever job that future child may have does not exist even sure. when they're in high school. And so they're going to have to learn it. And not just once, but many times during their career.
Right.
And so that ability to keep learning and ultimately how to optimize their own style of learning, because we each learn differently in different ways in different arenas. And to know that, to be trained, to actually have disciplined knowledge about how you learn best different ways is the ultimate golden key.
Superpower.
Yeah. It's a superpower. I have found nowhere teaching, nowhere is a single curriculum on how to learn how to learn, particularly how to personally learn how to learn your own way. And that is that kind of character that could be aided by technology.
Sure.
That ability.
But it doesn't currently exist in a format right, that you think
want
is
to
good.
Track and measure right. and practice.
Which stifles creativity ways. Because the moment you know you're being tracked, recorded, or observed, your behavior, I think, is going to change somewhat.
Right. And so that could be hidden, so you wouldn't even be aware of it. So
you wouldn't be able to measure that. Yeah.
Quantify self stuff. So that is a place that technology could help. But the other way in which you're kind of forming your character, how you deal with failure, you know, how you deal with criticism, how you select what you want to do, what governs you.
Has to be modeled by parents or influencers.
Yeah. I mean, in some senses, you may be protecting a child from
right.
things like that. I mean, personally, my own personal story is that our kids grew up without TV. We didn't have TV in the house. But I was one of the very first Netflix subscribers. And so, you know, this is before streaming. But so they were seeing a lot of maybe the same content, but it was under different circumstances. What they didn't see were the commercials.
Right.
My kids were pretty old before the first time they saw a commercial, and they were completely bamboozled. It was like, what is this program? It's inside the program. And they were like, wah, wah, wah. And
so
we had to have a, you know, a teaching moment about what it is and why it's there. So I can certainly see parenting being in some ways kind of trying to manage the technology, because I think.
And filter, right?
Right. I think there really is a difference in the technology for adults versus for kids and how it works. And I think that's, you know, right now we're paying attention to YouTube, kids YouTube. That's a very good thing to pay attention to. My only advice is let's look at the data rather than imaginary possibilities.
Sure.
I mean, we tend to, our minds rapidly go to what if kept in this direction, what would happen? Yes, that's a concern, but we should be making decisions on actually what we know, what the data suggests. Like recently, there was this kind of a fear about the YouTube algorithms directing people to a more extreme version.
I saw that, yeah.
Well, I did that. I just recently did that test myself. Is that true? It wasn't true at all. In fact, it was the opposite. It tended to bring everything to the most bland, like TED Talks. It was just like got stuck on TED Talks forever, or like sports and stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, I mean, and I was just N1. So, but the other examples from the paper were also just N1. So we need to have more data. We need to have, if we're going to make these kinds of decisions or policies.
We don't yet have the data sets though, which is challenging, but it's going to be fun to create them, right?
Exactly. Should be fun. Let's fund those data sets. And again, you know, if you had a request to fund someone studying YouTube videos, it's often laughed at, but that's okay. We need to do that.
Yeah. And I think that technology companies, they're probably going to be the drivers of this research because, you know, you say that and the head of corporate investment at Google hears, okay, we need to acquire 4 recommendation engines. This is how we're going to go about that. So what's the role of technology companies in funding this research? They're already doing it directly and indirectly. Do you feel inspired by that? Or is that something we should be cautious of?
It's only natural that the companies were going to fund research in the hopes that they, you know, improve what they're doing. Hopefully, they're also wise enough to fund research that's open-ended and they don't know what the answer is going to be. More importantly, and Facebook was burned a little bit by this, but they should open up their data to independent researchers. And that was some of the Cambridge Analytics came in that way, where they actually did that, but the researchers weren't, they were compromised and they So they really screwed over Facebook, because Facebook was trying to do the right thing of saying, here's our data, you do, you know, research it. But they were doing more than that. They were trying to manipulate people's opinions. So I think all the above. One is, yes, big corporations should fund this research as much as they can. Secondly, they should allow independent science, you know, university impartial researchers to use their data to come up with new things. And then the government should probably do some kind of, you know, funding of independent research as well. We have the data, but you know, the curious thing is that the more concerned we are about the data, the more restrictions there are. It even makes it hard for researchers.
Sure.
And so it's like either we have to have exceptions for researchers, but again, the Cambridge Analytic thing was for research purposes, so they can be abused. I am pro continuous ongoing research in all things, including, like, say, drugs. So that we have this really weird system right now. It's weird. It wasn't in the beginning, but now it's a weird system with the FDA where a drug will be invented and then it'll be tested through this very elaborate long process that may cost $500 million at this point. And then the drug is released and it's like never tested again. As soon as it's released, it can be used for all kinds of things that are off the label.
Now it's being tested in the real world. Prior to that, right. It has not been tested in the real world.
None of those are really being captured and quantified. So what we want is basically constant vigilance, constant testing. So we should constantly be testing things. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't say, well, they were approved 20 years ago. So I'm for a data-driven, constant measurement of all kinds of things.
That's how we avoid blowups, right? Or black swan events, or that's how we maybe get a handle on those? Or how do you view that?
If you're always testing things, which is expensive.
Sure.
Somebody has to pay for it. Again, it may be part of the government. It may be part of the deal with the inventors of the technology is, well, part of your responsibility. You have these rights. We'll give you a monopoly for 7 years.
Right.
But part of that is you have to keep testing for those 7 years.
Right. And then maybe afterwards the data goes into a public trust or what are some scenarios there?
And speaking of that, there's so many things we can still do to evolve the scientific method. All kinds of experiments happened and there was like, well, there's no correlation, so they don't publish. But no. That was very useful information to know.
Sure.
Those results should be published. Basically, all the data that we're collecting for every experiment should be posted.
Seems like the right thing ethically to do.
Sure. And scientifically.
Yeah. You've written a lot recently about Mirror World, and there's a great essay in Wired that I would recommend. It's called AR Will Spark the Next Big Tech Platform. Call it Mirror World.
Not my title, by the way. Go ahead.
What was the title you were going with?
Mirror World.
Mirror World. I like that. But it does, you know, rank number one for when you search Mirror World now. So at least there's that. I love the essay. When did you start writing it? And I would be curious, what is the genesis of your writing process for this?
That's a good question. I had written a previous Wired cover story on VR, virtual reality, and it was centered around Magic Leap, which was kind of actually making an augmented reality glasses. And so I was kind of aware of Magic Leap and had gone down and tested this stuff and tried it out, and a couple other AR glasses that were also not far behind Magic Leap. For me, I thought that this augmented reality world where you have see-through glasses and you have this marriage melding of the real world and the virtual world together had more potency, had more power, and it seemed to me to be kind of more likely that would be where we would first encounter this. And so it kind of ended there. That was ended. But somewhere along the line, I saw a reference in, you know, one of the tech blogs somewhere about this idea called the AR cloud, which was being talked about as the VCs looking at the AR cloud. I said, the AR cloud, what is that? And then the vision was that it was a mirror world, basically, but they weren't calling it that. And it was sort of there was this sort of brief kind of talks about this idea. And so I started to research to see, well, how real was this? And the idea was that you took the AR vision and you hooked all the AR glasses together and you had this emergent AR cloud, or what I would call eventually mirror world. So I started to try and find out through the VC kind of view where they were funding, what was happening. And at some point, it seemed like there was enough going on that maybe this should have a name. And I encountered the guy who made up the world, AR cloud, had a conference called Augmented World Expo in Santa Clara. So I emailed him and I got in and I went and attended all the sessions. And it was clear that there was something happening, but it was also clear that nobody had really painted a picture of it. So I pitched it to Wired and saying that I think there's something here. Nobody's described it. I think there is enough real that I'm not just kind of making up science fiction, that we could actually describe it. And so they gave me a couple months to, I spent actually the rest of the year kind of doing the interviews, researching it, talking to people. And then I think by the end of the year and Christmas, I think I did the final. So that was like the conference was in the spring, and then kind of, so it took me like a year to put it together. And a lot of it was just talking out loud, visiting the different people and trying out the idea to see whether there was anything there.
So by anything there, do you mean something like a new platform, a new industry? Was that what got you excited about it? What was, can you elaborate on that?
For me, the reason it was worth kind of putting it out was that I came to the conclusion that the mirror world was the next platform, the big operating system platform that followed smartphones, which had followed the web. So that this was like the third iteration of a platform. Just as there was the web was this immense platform that enabled lots of things to happen. And then we had the smartphones and social media, which was another big platform, and that this was going to emerge to be the third stage, the next platform after smartphones. It would be smart glasses. And so so that was sort of the hook. That was why it was worth taking that trouble. It wasn't just another kind of thing. There was actually a pretty big, influential, consequential thing with many opportunities at many levels. And so that made it for me worth talking about.
So when you start to discuss these ideas, do you gravitate towards original content? Are you thinking about gaming? Are you thinking about education? Are there any core verticals that are really inspiring your research that you're passionate about?
Not especially. I'm not a big gamer. And by the, you know, and a lot of this will probably be driven by gamers. There's a quote in the Mirror World piece by
the CEO of Niantic.
Of Niantic, John Hinckley, who says basically that, you know, gamers in general, the gaming world is inventing all the new cool technology that can be then used in other sectors. And there may be some truth in that. And so, but I'm not a gamer myself. I'm not naturally a person who plays games, though I try to, again, watch others. I watch my son when he plays games. I have a nephew who's a total 12, you know, one of these, you hear about the 12-year-olds, you're anonymously some guy is on the head of the leaderboard and he's right. 12 years old. Well, he's one of those guys. He's not 12 anymore, but he's probably 14. So I'm always kind of watching him. When you go visit him, I wanted to see him play. I wanted to ask him what he's doing.
Are his aspirations to join an esports team? I'm curious, or is that kind of
Yeah. But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Right now it's just for fun, or he's kind of competitive.
Yeah, kind of exactly. He has his guilds and they just cream guilds. And that's fun for him, I guess. So I do pay attention to it, but I not in exclusion of other things. I pay attention to what's happening in health, because that's another place where there's a huge amount of data and a lot of this stuff is happening. So I try not to close my mind too much. I try to be a little bit agnostic about things in general, just because I feel I don't want to come to early premature conclusions, which can kind of blind oneself later on.
Right, because those premature conclusions can form dogma or dogmatic thinking very quickly. So in an emerging industry like this, I would imagine the ultimate advantage would be to have beginner's mind. Would it be to be experimenting a lot? How are you going about gathering your information to study Mirror World and its emergence?
So in general, my take on trying to look at where technology is going is I try to look at where the early versions of it are being misused, not the official ideas, because generally what we, even the ventures, what they think the technology is going to be used for is not how it actually is. And so I'm paying attention to how it's being misused by students, by outlaws, by criminals, by hackers, by people who are not using it officially.
Right.
That tells me a little bit more about what technology wants in the sense of it's kind of is showing its biases. And so I can follow it better. So I do look at early adopters. I look at the science as much as possible. And again, that's part of the hard part for me is I'm not a super technical person, but I really try to read the papers and talk to the experts and like truly trying to understand what it is, because there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of hand waving. There's a lot of, sort of like conventional wisdom, which not all of that is true or helpful, and trying to understand exactly what's happening in a way that I can tell someone else is part of what I'm trying to do. And I, you know, again, I can get a little bit sense of what the technology wants when I actually look at the science.
And by teaching, does that help you discover kind of where you're at knowledge wise in the space?
Well, I write in order to understand what I think. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what I think until I try to write it. So writing for me is a way of thinking that's it. So I, you know, each time I sit down and think, okay, I know what this is. And I start to write it in two sentences and I realize I have no idea. So I have to go back and do more interviews and I do another sentence. Okay, I got it now. And then it's like, wait a minute. And then I'm stuck again. So writing is just forcing me to think clearly, to research, to be able to describe it, because I keep thinking in my head, I know what this is. And then as soon as I have to try to write it, I realize I don't really know.
It sounds like when you approach a new space, in this case, Mirror World, and the future of VR and AR and mixed realities, you're kind of looking at it through the lens of, okay, there are these black hat applications, there are these white hat applications. Now I'm trying to imagine, what are the gray hat applications? What are the gray hat applications that are going to be so useful that they're going to proliferate all over the world? Is that how you kind of think about it? Or is that a useful mental model for thinking about the space?
It would be. I'm not sure I actually do that. I like that idea. Mostly what I'm trying to do is, and I didn't set out this way, but I would say looking back at what I'm doing for Wired and what I naturally try to gravitate to is I'd like to try to make frameworks. I wouldn't call them theories, but kind of like a framework. I like to generalize things. It's like the question is a little bit kind of like what you mean by the gray area. I like to say, well, this is what's happening here. This is what's happening here. What's the general case?
Sure.
That unites those things. If you have, if VR can do this and AR can do this, what's the general attribute that they both share? So it's a method of generalizing to try to make a framework to try to understand it, because I find it easier to understand things if there's a framework. So like, okay, if we understand that this is a new platform, that helps us understand what's going on. If we understand that it's that it's the emergence of two different realms together into one, that helps us understand what they're trying to do with the glasses. If this is a matter of that it's a one-to-one map of the entire world, that helps us understand the scale of things. And so those kind of metaphors or frames are what I'm always trying to extract out. So I'm saying, well, this is this and this and this. What connects all that? What's the pattern that connects these things that we can generalize and say, well, that's true. So we can predict, therefore, that the next one over here will finish it because we have a framework. We have a theory.
So it sounds like maybe the best way to start exploring these spaces is to start to build our own pattern matching systems for the industry. So are there any particular patterns or trends in the Mirror World that you're particularly excited about right now? Is it the work that Magic Leap's doing? Is it the work that Microsoft's doing with HoloLens?
Just 2 days ago, a CEO sent me a link to the work of a company that I have been kind of aware of, haven't been following very much, is called Matterform. And they are doing the scanning, the 3D world scanning at a large scale. And they, the little demo they did was the Taliesin West, Frank Lloyd Wright's Western Institute. They scan his property and the all the buildings. And so you can do kind of like a walkthrough, even without, but with the glasses. And it's remarkably robust in terms of the capture, the volumetric capture of this campus, we'll mm-hmm. call it, inside the buildings, outside, in kind of the seamless way you can kind of transverse going through. And you get a hint of what's coming.
And better volumetric capture is key to creating.
Right. And volumetric capture for the benefit is a true three-dimensional picture of something from any possible angle, including up, down, below, that actually gives you a sense of that volume, that space that it occupies. So, you know, people think of this kind of like a Google Street View, but the thing about Google Street View is it's not very volumetric. There's no sense that you can go into those buildings and as you're passing through the door that the walls actually have thickness. That's true volumetric capture where everything has a volume. It's not just flat like a theater flat. And so
to the point where your mind agrees with it, right?
Right. And or more importantly, to the mind, to the point where you are convinced and feeling like
you get
you're
that
there.
Feeling, right.
And this goes to me, the kind of aha moment that I had at Stanford Labs when Jeremy Ballaston, who runs their VR lab, was doing the demo. And that was that this stuff, even the smart glasses, when they're doing the true augmented reality, is that it works on a different part of your brain than the part of your brain that sees things and watches things. It works on the part of your brain that is tricking you into believing that something's present, that you're present. Things are present. And just like we have another part of our brain that on a screen where we see things move, we believe things are moving. So we watch a film of a rocket taking off. We say, well, that rocket went across us, you know, went across the screen. No, the rock, there was no movement at all. Those are just still pictures, one after another. Mm-hmm. And that sense of movement that we would swear was there was just an illusion. It's just a trick. That is one part of our brain. But the other part of the brain where we're tricked into believing that this is really here or that you are really here as an avatar, you feel that you're really there, even though we know you couldn't possibly be there.
Sure.
That sense of experiencing things is very powerful. That's the new superpower that these AR and VR give, is a sense of presence, tricking you to believe that you're experiencing something even when you're not. And that is that kind of this, you know, internet of experiences that we're making with this mirror world.
And this is going to be the key to authentic telepresence, right? Or the promise of telepresence has been, you know, you've been studying technology for a while. I'm curious, when did the theories about telepresence first start coming onto the scene? And is the dream going to be realized or no?
I mean, it was a science fiction fantasy for a very long time. And I saw VR, virtual reality, in the 80s. And I thought, you know, it was going to be the next 5 years. It just seemed, because the VR, the best VR in the 80s was actually about the same as good as the Oculus, the first version of the Oculus.
Yeah.
And so it was like, oh, this is around the corner. Well, the problem is, it was just the price. The problem is those setups back in the 80s cost $1 million. So what you got with the Oculus wasn't really any better. It just said it was like $1,000 instead of $1 million. But that's actually still not good enough. We need to have like $100. Mm-hmm.
That's so 10 times better.
Yeah. So when we get to $100 or maybe even $10, then that's when we're going to see. And it doesn't even be any better than what the Oculus was. But if it's $100, it'll be pretty good.
And just if it was on a recurring subscription right there, like the economics start to make sense for a large platform where it becomes feasible? Or what are your thoughts there?
I mean, I think so. The economic models of the mirror world are, I think they'll be varied in many. Maybe there will be some hardware manufacturers that will make money like selling iPhones. Maybe an Apple-like company that makes really cool, powerful, well-designed glasses that everybody wants. Okay. So there's a chance, but there aren't going to be many of those. It could be like one or two that can actually do that.
And they might quickly become commoditized as right. well.
But like, you know, most of the money, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. Who makes most of the money on telecom? Is it Apple or the telecoms in general? I don't know. But, you know, you basically, for most people, you kind of get a free phone for promising to pay your money to the phone company. There'll be subscriptions just to the service. That's another model. And then there'll be tons of apps and things where they're trying to sell for additional services.
Tools and upgrades.
There'll be some people charging for, you know, ability to add layers of information, worlds, games. I mean, certainly there's going to be tons of games played in the real world, like a Pokemon Go sure. kind of a thing. People will pay for that.
I see MMORPGs really driving a lot of the first applications that are going to reach scale in the mirror world. MMORPGs that lead a user to a better personal outcome in their real world life, perhaps.
I think multiple player games and reality based games are going to be really big, and they will drive. But I'm not sure that that will be the main driver. My prediction is that most people will encounter this technology first at work.
Yes, agreed.
And then they will migrate into everyday life. But they'll do it either with the 80% of the people who don't work at desks in the world, wearing these glasses kind of brings them in, gives them powers to repair, train, guide, schedule, etc. Then there's all the desk-bound people who can have the virtual screens in their virtual office. And then if there's any kind of a promise of telepresence,
sure,
that's huge. And so, I mean, telepresence, virtual telepresence is a service technology that I would pay an immense amount of money personally. I would pay like, I don't know, hundreds of dollars a month, many thousands of dollars a year if I could
be my AR representation here
and have an avatar sit there and have a conversation.
Yeah.
It would just be so powerful. And then you add into this the other powerful technology, I think, coming that will really disrupt the world's economy, which is real-time translation. So there are people around the world who are highly skilled in all kinds of things, but lack the one skill of being able to be fluent in English. If you had real-time translation, the kind of dabble fish where you are translating in real time, that just opens up and unleashes so much to people who, again, have great talent, but not the talent of speaking English. And they can participate in this global economy in a way that they could not before. And so that's also part of this mirror world technology, in my view, which is, you know, it's not just visual, it's also audio. Talking to your assistant, your digital AI with your back and forth in voice. So yes, so there is a huge, to me, a huge economic component in just the change in the way we employ people, how we do work. These artificial virtual screens and rooms. I think for a lot of people, that's where they're first going to encounter this.
What are your thoughts on the idea of a more perfect logos? So in philosophy and religious history, I think Philo Judaeus had this concept that we weren't going to communicate as humans as good as we could, or we wouldn't get to a place where we'd create heaven on earth until we could visualize the logos a bit more so we could see what each other what we meant instead of what we were saying, because often words are very imperfect, yeah. right? They're an imperfect medium of communication. Yeah. And what I mean when I say something is different than your, you know, internal right, dictionary right. might imagine. So is there a future of communication here that might be really exciting for, you know, to connect humans in a positive sure. way?
What you're talking about sounds a little bit like what Jaron Lanier, one of the pioneers.
Of 10 arguments for deleting your social media accounts.
No, before this,
okay.
Jaron Lanier is one of the pioneers to develop virtual reality. He coined the term virtual reality, or at least popularized it. And at the time that I was talking about in the 80s, his VPL had the state-of-the-art VR rig, and he was making the gloves and the whole system. That was the one that was probably as good as Oculus is now. So for many years, he was trying to write his very first book, and we were doing it by I was taping conversations with him, and the book was something about what he called post-symbolic language.
Okay.
And he was sort of, I think, talking about what you're talking about. Well, his idea is that if you had this system, a VR system that was good enough, you could conjure up a representation of a banana faster than you could say banana or even type it banana.
Right. Especially with mind-brain interfaces. Right.
So or that you like would that. Show.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly show what you meant. What you were saying.
Right. And the person could like ask questions and thoughts.
And so the other person is kind of reading what you're saying in a, he called it post-symbolic. And I never quite understood exactly what he was talking about because a banana that's there is a symbol kind of, but he says, no, it really is the banana. So anyway, if you want more of that, I never fully grasped what it was. So I don't know the answer,
I'll but
you should
research.
Ask Jaron because
that's fascinating.
He'll give you a couple of days worth of of expansion on that.
Sure. Very cool. So when you're presenting Mirror World to someone for the first time who is very excited about it, or you feel like the moment is right to kind of like turn them on to Mirror World, how do you do that? What's the biggest benefit of Mirror World for the average person?
That's a really fair question. I don't have an easy way to do it because I think we're at this point where even the inventors of this technology don't know what it's really going to be used for.
Sure. And some of them might know that and be quite aware that.
Well, right. And so I'm not using this every day at this point. So it's really hard to imagine what it will be. But there are a number of different, what I would think are kind of immediate uses. And again, going back to the way I think it's going to come into the world. So I think the first uses are going to be in places like occupations where they need to do repair or training. The repair is where complicated machinery has to be repaired. It's very, very complicated. Technically, it's a real stretch for people to kind of know if they have more than one machines, is knowing how they work. And so the way this works is that you have this thing that you see the real machine, and you have this overlay, virtual overlay of what is what and where things may be broken and what wire to move over here.
And decision trees visualized for you in a sense, right?
Right. Well, there could be someone, the expert could be looking over your shoulder and says, okay, reach over there, this nut here, turn it this way. And then over here's, and then they point up to it. So they see this overlay of the real thing and the virtual understanding of it. And they get to work. And this actually not theory. This absolutely works and is being used today. That kind of training and education could also be used. How about learning how to weld? So I did try something where I learned how to weld by watching YouTube. Well, this was a better version of YouTube because this was a real demo where there was a machine and it can see my hand. I can shadow puppet the right position, and it's giving me direct, immediate feedback. It's like having a real master look over my shoulder and with his or her hand moving it to the right place and saying, no, you can move up a little bit here. I can just tell. And so
apprenticeships, right?
Very, very powerful. It's very, very powerful. So for me, one of the visions of this is kind of like a better YouTube, YouTube in the sense of the tutorial universe of instructional how to's and how to do things and stuff. It's teaching. It's really made for, it's a teaching medium, a learning medium like none other. So that's one area. Then there unfortunately is a whole shopping scenario that I think will happen, but that's so obvious and inevitable that, you know, it's not really not talking about, but it does work where you have your glasses and you can imagine and visualize a different chair here, and you can walk around it and you can really feel what that chair would look like, the right scale. You can just snap your fingers and get different fabrics on it. You can move it around virtually where you want it. And that, again, you are experiencing it. It works on you in a very different way. And it's very close to what the actual chair would look like. So that kind of an experience in trying things on and shopping will be one of the first things that will come along. And then there's this kind of the informational overlay of like, here's something else I would pay for. I hope it happens, is that I want to have your name over your head if I've met you before.
Yeah.
Just reminding.
When we're walking around, right?
We're coming up, you know, so, because I'm always forgetting people's names.
Sure, same.
I the day after. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
I've been in workshops where the next morning I come in and it's nice to meet you. It's like, we worked together yesterday afternoon.
Yeah,
like,
I've completely whiffed on people's names and called them. I'm very confidently calling them the wrong thing.
I want that little hovering over. Sure. But Chad, you're right.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, that would be immensely valuable to me.
Yeah. And seeing, you know, like recent quotes or context and
well, when that, we that last would be fun met or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, that kind of stuff, there's privacy issues, which we haven't talked about right. this, but I hope that
in the settings though, I can opt into what type of information I want to display.
Well, and like, that's part of the conversation.
Definitely. So how do we get to a future for sci-fi and original content and the games in the mirror world where they're positive? How do we avoid a future of dystopia? Because it seems like Hollywood wants more dystopias and that the people who buy from Hollywood yeah. seem to want more dystopias too. How do we get to a brighter future for stories?
The beautiful thing is that, yes, there are only a couple hundred Hollywood movies made every year. I call them the, you know, apex charismatic species. You know, their lions are kind of rare and charismatic, but there is this huge biomass ecosystem below.
Long tail, right?
This pyramid that supports them. So the lions require, you know, I don't know, hundreds of antelope or gazelles below them. The gazelles feed on, you know, acres and acres and acres of millions of blades of grass, and the grass depends on, like, you know, billions of microbes. And so I think there's a similar kind of pyramid in video. So at the apex, you have the 500 Hollywood movies, but there's, you know, there's tons of video shorts on YouTube, and below that there's, you know, gazillions of things that people make on their phones. And so I think the way to change what Hollywood does is to change what's below, what it's feeding on, what it depends on. So there's no gatekeeper in terms of anybody making a video or writing a science fiction story. There's fanfic sites, there's huge. And so for me, the way to start it is just to ourselves produce individually
better memes, better stories.
Work on a future that we want to live in.
Right.
But the thing is that future cannot say, well, we're not going to have AI. We're not going to have robots. And we're not going to have gene editing. No, those are all inevitable. We have to make a future that we want, a picture where there is ubiquitous AI. There is ubiquitous gene therapy. There is ubiquitous data collection. What does that role look like?
Right.
And so
what's a vision look like?
Rather than waiting for the professionals to do it, I think we should try to say, well, what is it the world that we want? What would that look like? What would I be happy with?
When it comes to that world, are there any glimpses that you can provide of what the future golden age looks like, or a future for technology that you're excited that your kids get to live in and participate in? What's that future world look like for you?
For me, the most fundamental technological change coming that will touch every aspect of our lives is artificial intelligence. There is nothing that I can think of from fashion, sports, religion, military, education that's not going to be impacted by this. But my vision of this is that these AIs, in plural, are all smart, but none of them think like humans. They're all, it's kind of like a zoo. There's a zoo of many different species of minds. Some of them being quite primitive, like animals, some of them being aliens. So they can be very smart in some ways, but they're aliens. And I think we're going to be frustrated a lot of the time because these AIs will be really super smart in one area and completely dumb in another.
Which might be like a first contact type experience for
yes,
us.
Yes, it's like, we're just like, you dumb smarting thing. It's like, you're so intelligent, but you can unlock the safe, but you can't find the safe in the room. And so the view that I have is that we're going to be working with all these varieties of AIs in various capacities, sometimes very frustratingly. Sometimes they're going to suggest things that they're going to think differently. And so thinking different is the engine of creation and innovation and wealth. And if we're all connected together 24 hours a day with our devices, it's very hard to have a different idea. But having AIs think differently is actually going to help us come up with different ideas. So the world I'm looking at is us working with and partnering with other kinds of thinking. And then, you know, various robots and stuff that have various levels of intelligence, some of them very restricted and narrow to do one thing. And a lot of our time may be spent kind of managing, just like we spend time managing different technologies, we may be managing different AIs.
Different AI versions of ourselves, maybe, or
they're going to be so programs. Unlike us. Yeah. They're very, very unlike us. They will be. We will engineer AIs to be creative, but their creativity will be different. It's like we'll engineer them to be funny, but they're not going to have our sense of humor.
Right.
It's like
they just might augment our potential for humor.
It's like a Spock, right?
Sure.
It's like, you know, they're kind of like, they're smart, but they're just not with us. And I think for a very, very, very long time, as far as I can imagine, we're going to always prefer to have small talk and hang out with other humans.
Sure.
Because there's an ease, a fundamental relaxing resonance that we're going to have. Even as smart or funny or creative as an AI, they're going to be alien. They're going to be really like, they're just like,
they could supplement
only,
the conversation.
Only AI would think that was really funny.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. You made a joke. I get the joke, but it's not really funny for humans.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, I think that's the world where we're going to have lots of help, assistance, things whispering into our ear. If we want the answer to a question, we ask a machine. But if we want a good question, we hire a human. Right. And so humans are going to be really good at asking questions. And that kind of a sense where we're working with, so the world I imagine is where there's the ubiquitous zoo of kinds of AI doing different things. Some of us will become better at talking to them than others. We'll have to navigate, just as we have kind of a landscape of how we find answers and the internet. We'll have to figure out how we navigate through all these different AIs, and that'll be skill for some people as well, who may have a kind of intuitive sense of how these things all, the different kinds of AIs work. But I think it's a zoo. It's not a single big AI. It's kind of all these little things. It's going to be very frustrating for a lot of people. And I'm the first to say that there will be whole new problems, big problems, major problems that are going to be created by these. They are going to be making decisions about who gets the mortgage and who doesn't. It will be very hard for us to understand what their logic is. It's going to require we have to make a second AI that actually watches that AI to tell us how it works. And so we're going to have these complexes of things, and we'll be in a constant conversation with them about their decisions and why they decided certain things and who do we appeal to for that. So there, you know, more of our time and cognition will be spent talking about these, just as we gossip about our friends.
Right. We'll be programming the morality in a sense, or yes. It's very important that we develop that meta skill fast.
So, you know, programming morality is a good term, because actually it turns out that it's not difficult to put in values or morality or ethics into an AI. That's not difficult. It's just code.
Right. It's or like, in a sense, modeling
like
them ourselves.
It's like loading code and laws and things, or just code. We can do that. The difficult part is that we as humans don't really know what our values are. And secondly, our values are very inconsistent and very, very shallow.
Right.
Once we start to examine them and try to put them into some kind of structure.
And look at what
philosophers
and
others have been doing for a long time. That's what they've been trying to do. Is we realize we're inconsistent. We're shallow. We're just horrible. And so the real problem or the challenge ahead of us is actually becoming better. Coming up with better ethics and morality that we can then give to the robots. So in the kind of the long-term way, I think this process is going to make us better humans.
I agree. I think it's going to give us a mirror that we can stand to look in that's helpful. Right. That's the hope. So Kevin, thank you so much for joining us and being generous with your time. I recommend all of your books. This has been fascinating. We'll have to get you back on for round two at some point. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks you for the great questions. You're obviously a great human.
Mission Daily and all of our podcasts are created with love by our team at mission.org. We own and operate a network of podcasts and a brand and story studio designed to accelerate learning. Our clients include companies like Salesforce, they're a customer times five, Twilio, and Katerra, who work with us because we produce results. To learn more and get our case studies, check out mission.org/studios. If you're tired of media and news that promotes fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and if you want an antidote to all that chaos, you're at the right place. Subscribe here and to our daily newsletter at mission.org. Each morning, you'll get a newsletter that will help you start your morning and your day off right.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning into this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. It helps spread the word, and I would greatly appreciate it. See you next time.